But the building that they're going into is not finished. The floors are still dirt.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think we're good. Okay.
Where is it?
Vineyards in Lewis.
Okay.
Good morning. I'd like to call the November 13th Pension Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the August 15th minutes. Are there any questions, changes, or concerns? Okay, hearing none, the minutes will stand approved. The second item is the actuarial assumptions. We had an experience study done to review our assumptions. John Lessel is here to talk about the study.
Good morning.
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 If you open up the folder that is at your station there, it is the first item on the right.
Looks like this with our letterhead on the front.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hopefully this will be very interesting for you this morning, a little bit different. An experience study is not something that gets done that regularly. The idea behind an experience study, I don't know if you've all had much of an opportunity to look at this, but just a few words about it first. The idea here is to go back carefully and look at the experience, usually for the last 5 years or so, and compare that to the actuarial assumptions that we've been using for the valuation. As you know, we make assumptions about projecting what future benefits are expected to be paid out of the pension plan, and using these assumptions to actually project amounts and so on, and then the investment return to discount those future cash flows down to a current present value so that we can work with that. But what happens is, a very legitimate question is, why are you using those assumptions? So an experience study is a way to help provide justification for that, to test how accurate the assumptions may be, maybe make changes, revisions, improve the assumptions. But also, even if you didn't make any changes at all, even if we were perfect in our assumptions that we've been using, you still want to have this kind of evidence periodically to show that. And so that's what we've done here today. We looked at six different assumptions that are listed at the bottom of that first page, and what we'll be doing is going through, looking at that. We'll make some recommendations. We'll also have the cost impact if you were to make the change in assumptions that we're recommending. And then presumably the final thing will be to make some decisions today about what assumption changes you'd want to do, and then we anticipate doing that effective for the January 1, 2014 valuation. The thing about the assumptions is, well, one thing first to just kind of understand or talk about is the fact that whatever the assumptions are, they're not really going to affect the cost of your plan ultimately. The cost of the plan is going to be whatever the benefits actually are that you end up paying out to people, less the expenses of operating the plan, and the return that you actually achieve. So ultimately, it really affects just the timing of things like when you would be making your contributions and so on. And that's why I think you may find some of it, the results here, a little surprising, where we make what would appear to be a pretty significant change in assumptions, and it doesn't have that great an impact on the results, because ultimately it's just changing some of the timing of that cash flow that I mentioned. also, there are offsetting changes, and we had a lot of that this time. So that overall, if you were to make all of the assumptions that we're recommending, it's not that great an impact on your plan, which in one way we can look at and say, well, that means our assumptions weren't that bad before. And so that's actually kind of good news. It might seem like all this effort for little impact, but again, it's a demonstration. So... And then finally, about just talking about assumptions in general, they're not, they're a shared responsibility, ultimately. I mean, obviously, the assumptions are something that I have to be comfortable with if I'm going to certify to the actuarial soundness of your plan or certify to the required contributions and so on. But also, this is something that that you all have a hand in. You know your workforce. You have your ideas about what's going to happen in the future, what directions you're heading in, and so on. And so none of this, don't take any of our recommendations here as absolute. I fully would expect, you know, you all to have different ideas about it, and, you know, the final product that we end up with may be a bit different than what we're recommending here. And again, that's fine. So certainly give and take here. Interrupt with any questions that you have. And even more important, if you have other ideas about what's going on, what we should be projecting in the future, please share them. Okay? If we might get started then, if we could look at page one. The first assumption that we looked at was the retirement experience. For other employees, by that we mean everyone except paramedics and dispatchers. And in the black area there, that is the what we call the exposure, which means over the five-year period that we look backwards, how many life years were exposed to possibly retiring. In other words, how many times was somebody eligible to retire, whether they actually did or not, during that 5 years? And you'll see there were 19 occasions where somebody could have gone out for early retirement and 83 occasions for normal retirement. Now, I have to modify that a little bit because when we started working with this, and of course we do a lot of study before we get to this final page. I found that in your case, there was a significant amount of retirements occurring after 30 years, regardless of age. And that experience was quite a bit different than the experience strictly based on age, right, that you see here. So I found that I was able to get a better fit to the experience by actually breaking retirement into three components: early retirement, normal retirement meaning 62, and then the 30 and out, which we'll get to, I think it starts on page 3. It just happens that the format that I use only lets me look at two at a time, which is probably just as well, because this gets confusing. So all of these retirement exposures that we have here are factoring out the people that were eligible for 30 and out. That's not included here yet. The blue numbers then, that shows the current assumption. And currently, we are using no assumption, of early retirement. So you'll see just zeros there. And then you see the 30, the 71, and the 100%. That's basically what you have there is your assumption is that out of 100 people that are eligible to retire, 30 of them will go at age 62, 50 of them will go at 65, and 20 will go at age 67. And if you figure out those percentages, that means 30% the first time at age 62, out of the 70 that are left, 50 go that at 65, that's 71%, and then finally at 67, everybody else who's left. The red numbers then show the actual experience. It shows, for instance, that we had, in fact, you see at the bottom there, two early retirements and 18 normal retirements. Over the five-year period looking backwards. And then as a result of that, and I met with Michael Schooley, who's the actuary that certifies for your OPEB plan, and he and I went over these extensively and kind of came up with some recommendations And this is really kind of the art part, you know, up until going through the red numbers is strictly deterministic mathematics. We use computers and crank these things out. But then getting to the green, that's where we kind of scratch our heads and say, well, you know, what kind of makes sense? We don't necessarily want to do exactly what past experience dictates. As you know, past is not necessarily an indication of the future. But we make some judgment, apply some art, use some traditional approaches that we're familiar with, and come up with some recommendations. So we're suggesting, for instance, here that we might assume about 10% of people elect early retirement at age 60, and another 10% at age 61. With the exposures you had over the last 5 years, that would have given us 1.9 retirements, very close to the two you actually had. Okay? And then, likewise, we introduced different percentages for normal retirement beginning at age 62, you know, a little dip at 64, but then a jump at 65 up to 40%, which is kind of traditional, and then grading down, and then finally not assuming everyone's going to retire until we reach age 70 plus. Okay. Page 2 is exactly the same figures at the top.
Mr. Lessel, wait 1 second. Dave Baker has a question.
Just one question. Mm-hmm. We had, I know the county had like 3 different early retirement programs after 2008, eliminated early retirement options that I'm sure affected. I mean, we had, a lot more than 2 people participating. And I don't remember the exact number, but when you say early retirement, do you mean like 15 years and out, or what?
It's age 60 and 15 years.
So if somebody had like 20 years at age 60, that you would classify that as early?
Yes, because they haven't reached 62 yet.
Okay. Well,
We did talk about it briefly about early retirement when we were first doing the study, that there was 2 done, 2009, 2011, and that I didn't envision that we probably would be doing that anytime soon because now everything is picking up again and things like that. So would you say that these numbers should be adjusted slightly because we wouldn't see the early retirements that we saw those 2 years?
Let me understand the early retirement study a little bit. I mean, the early retirement window, is that what you called it?
We had given, I believe, Karen, you can correct me wrong, we would give them extra years added so that, give them an incentive to retire early. So when the economy went down, we were trying to figure out how to lessen the staff that we had. So we offered 2 early retirement offers if anybody was interested so that they could retire early. And it was, we did it twice in this 5-year period.
Yeah, we picked, we were able to eliminate, it wasn't like countywide. It was like certain offices in particular that had a reduction in workload because of the change in the economy.
Okay.
The incentive was to give 3 additional years. So these numbers are probably a little inflated because otherwise they might not have taken that option because they wouldn't have qualified for the program. But with the additional 3 years, they did.
Okay. I didn't really focus on that, I have to admit. So maybe – well, 2 things are occurring to me maybe we do need to cut back a little bit on the retirement assumption. On the other hand, this assumption is being applied to all of the active employees. So it's a very long-range assumption. And Is it reasonable to assume that you might have these early retirement inducements? Again, not in the next couple of years, but you will perhaps have them in the next 10 or 20 years. And so in that sense, maybe we don't need to cut it back.
Karen, do you know how many people took those?
12 sticks in my mind. Does that sound right to you? Yeah. 12. And with those, you know, the incentive of the 3 years or getting them to eligibility, you know, was a key factor in those 12.
Sure.
So, do I think that it's going to happen anytime in the near future? Probably not. Because it was an elimination of the position. And I don't foresee that happening right now, the way things are picking up.
Okay.
But I do think that they probably are a little inflated because of those individuals may not have taken the retirement.
It turns out that assuming the people are going to retire earlier and is conservative. In other words, that's going to increase the liabilities by this assumption. So, I mean, I would be open to cutting it back if you all feel that way. I'll have to go back and think about it a little bit, maybe try to identify those 12 people, because in our database, I guess we didn't have them separately identified.
No, and what I can do is I can look back in my records and identify and send those to you.
Okay. And then I could tweak those results a bit for you, and if that would make the group more comfortable, I'm comfortable with that as well.
Another possible impact, have you considered in your recommendations, I presume you have, the changes in the full retirement age for Social Security and so forth? If you look back 5 years, the full retirement age might have been 65, and now it's 66 or even 67 for some folks. And will that have an impact, or does it have an impact to your analysis here?
Just in the art part, where we would say, you know, this is kind of based on you know, the actual data, we didn't come up, the recommended assumptions did not generate as many retirements as the current assumptions, but it did generate more retirements than the actual experience showed. So we, in other words, you had almost 46, should have had 46 retirements based on the assumptions. You actually only had 18. And I kind of split the difference with the 34. So in that sense, it was anticipating some change in the future, Social Security, other societal changes, and so on. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about maybe cutting it back a little bit more. Or really, what we're really talking about, even with this early retirement incentive, is pushing it off a little bit. Okay, people are still going to retire. They're just going to retire a few years later than they otherwise would have. So, I think what it'll have a smaller impact than you might at first think, because we're just, again, kind of changing that timing a little bit. But, does that answer your question enough? I'd be happy to tweak these for the retirement. I think that makes sense. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, the early retirement incentive. Page 3, this is where we looked at the 30 and out. And you'll see the actual experience and how that was actually spread over ages below 55, I mean, below 62, people that reached 30 years. I wonder, was the early retirement incentive giving people enough years to reach age 30 as well?
No, I don't think it affected any of those people, but it did add to the total amount. So if they could go out within 30 years, maybe they have 33 at that point.
I don't think it affected the eligibility, but it did add to the calculation for their pension.
Okay, so if somebody had 27 years and you offered them three more years, then they would have been eligible for 30 and out right then? Or was that group included?
I don't think we had any of those, really.
I was just wondering if some of those people were, in fact, in this third component, the 30 and out group, but it sounds like they weren't. Okay. But again, as you can see, the of course, the actual experience, we had no assumptions about people going out at once they reached 30 years. The actual experience, you can see there was quite a bit, total of 18 people, but quite a bit before age 62. And then, and so we recommended kind of smooth those percentages out, got them to come up with about the same number of retirements, 17.95, and making a recommendation of moving to a third assumption for the people who are eligible for 30 and out. And then finally on page 4, we looked at retirement for the dispatchers and paramedics, and their current assumption is 100% retire once they reach 25 years. But you can see here we had just very little exposure. There just weren't anybody. You know, we had 5 years, six life years of exposure. During that 5-year period, there were a total of 6 occasions where somebody had 25 years and could have gone out. And in fact, the actual experience showed only one. So in this case, there just really isn't enough data to analyze or make recommendations for changes. And so my thought was to just leave the 25 and out alone. It's conservative if we're assuming people are going to go earlier. And if, in fact, they don't go until a few years after that, which is what happened here, apparently, then there's a cost savings to the plan in that situation. So that covers the retirement, and if you'll turn momentarily to page 11, there you can see the cost and impact of the recommended assumption change. We have the current assumptions on the top line there based on the January 1, 2013 valuation. $2,784,000 was the annual required contribution. The actual accrued liability was the $70 million. The unfunded portion, the $11.436 million. And then the total value of all benefits, both accrued and expected to be earned in the future, was the $91 million. On line 2, you can see how those numbers change under these recommended retirement assumptions. An increase in the annual required contribution of $167,000, and an increase in the actuarial accrued liability and the unfunded accrued liability of $1.7 million.
Question on that. If we're changing if we currently assume, like on the regular employees, that we have 46 that are going to retire, and we're changing that to less, 34 that will retire, why would the liability increase?
A lot of that is the timing that that we're assuming some earlier retirements, both normal and especially the 30 and out.
Okay.
just these are just like crude numbers, but I like to think of it this way. Say you had an employee age 58, and he has 30 years of service. If he goes out right then, he's going to start his pension at 58 for the rest of his life. Okay. If he waits one more year, he'll have one additional year of service. So instead of 30 years, he'll have 31. So that's like a 3% increase in his benefit. But the fact that he's collecting it for 1 year less is like an 8 or 9% savings. It's like, well, you've probably heard of the actuarial equivalence adjustment for Social Security. It's the same sort of thing. If you start it later, it's worth less by generally more than the 3%. So overall, it's more expensive if you assume people retire earlier, less expensive if they retire later. Okay.
So there's a life expectancy assumption then as well.
The way it actually works, the mortality table has a certain probability that you'll survive to each possible age all the way out to like 115. So when we project that cash flow, we project a pension possibly being paid at every one of those ages, but the likelihood goes down as you get to the 115. So at the end of the table, that's those pension payments are contributing a small amount. And then when you discount that so many years, it has a small impact. But technically, we don't say a person's life expectancy is 16 years and value a certain annuity for 16 years. It's more rigorous than that. Page 5, then, looked at termination rates. The same kind of pattern, but a bit more complex, because termination tends to be more of a function of both service and age. And so what was just a one-dimensional column before becomes two dimensions here. We tried looking at possibilities of simplifying the termination rates, going with something that's more of a function of just age, or there's a technique that some plans are able to use called select and ultimate, where you just assume you have one set of termination rates for the first 5 years, regardless of age, and then you have other termination rates for after 5 years, regardless of service. They're based strictly on age. Your experience just didn't seem to fall into that kind of a pattern. I tried a lot of that. So, I'm sorry, I'm having some troubles here with my throat. I ended up staying with a similar structure that you have currently, but making some changes because the actual experience showed fewer people terminating than the assumption did. So in the upper left-hand corner in the black, again, you see the exposures. And across the top is how much service the people had, and down the left-hand side, their age groups. And we grouped them into five-year ages, because if you try to do it every age, you just don't get enough data to be able to draw conclusions. And then in the blue, you have the current assumptions for those same service and age cells. And I'll explain a little bit how they actually work. You actually have a set of assumptions for all possible ages for people with six or more years of service. That's the six plus in the right-hand column there. And then you'll see down below, your current assumption applies a factor to that rate. So if a person has six or more years, you see the factor in blue, current factor is 1.0. But if you have only 5 years, that rate of termination is multiplied by 1.5. If you have only 4 years, it's multiplied by 2, 2.5, 3, and 4. Everybody with me on that? So that's how your plan has been structuring the termination rates. And when you calculate them all out, put them into five-year age groups like we have here, weight them by the actual exposures that we had during the five-year period, you get those blue numbers there, and the black totals on the right-hand side or across the bottom show the total number of terminations that you would have expected. We would have expected, for instance, people with 1 year of service to have 7.04 terminations. Looking down the right-hand side for people 25 to 29, we would have expected 12.99 terminations and so on. Then in the lower left-hand corner, the red, that's the actual experience, and you can see that while the total number of terminations, 58 versus 56, 58.11 versus 56 were about the same, their distribution was quite a bit different. Again, less in the earlier years, a bit more at six plus years. And also the distributions, not as many at the earlier ages, more in the middle ages. Then it drops off. But then there was a kind of a jump at 60 to 61, or actually started at 55 to 59. We had the actual experience was 5 terminations, and 60 to 61 was 8. That seems to be people being hired late in life and working for a few years and then terminating. So anyway, after playing around with a lot of different things, what Mike and I came up with was that we could keep the same 6-plus rates as they varied by age. I'm looking now in the green section, the recommended. We did tweak the ages at 55 to 59 and 60 to 61, where the orange is there, you see, raised it to 3 and 10%. But otherwise, all we ended up doing was changing the factors. Instead of the blue current factors you see there, we ended up with the recommended green factors. A little bit fewer terminations in the earlier ages. And now if you start comparing the actual number of terminations across the bottom or on the right-hand side, the actual versus the recommended was a considerably closer fit. So that's what we are recommending for the males. And there seemed to be a certain logic to that, too. It's sort of saying the overall rates, other than tweaking them at the last ages there, 55 to 61, are about the same, but these factor adjustments were changing for the less than 6 years. We did something similar. I won't go into it, all the detail for the females. They definitely had females definitely had a different pattern of terminations. And we came up with, again, a slight adjustment at the late ages, and then mostly just recommending a change in factors, the recommended factors in green there. And when that's all said and done, again, flipping back to page 11, all of that change increased the annual required contribution by $76,000. Getting really exciting, isn't it? I'm sorry about that. It gets better from here out. These are the worst two, so that's why I put them first. Get them over with. All right. Surprising that it doesn't have a greater impact, but again, you know, it's really just changing some of the timing of when people are terminating, and it's, you know, we can point to all this and say we have a reason for using these assumptions. If you're ready, let's go on then to page 7. The next assumption that we looked at was the salary increases, and that's a whole lot simpler to view there. The current assumption has been for some time a straight 5% per year. At least during the last 5 years, the experience has been a lot less, averaging 2.9%. And we're recommending not using a constant assumption anymore, but using one that varies by ages, a little bit greater at the early ages, and then tapering off at the later ages, basically following the pattern that you see in the actual experience, and also the pattern that we generally see. You know, I mean, there are many clients that use a single rate, 5% for everybody, but there's also many clients that use an age-based rate like this, where it tapers off at the later years. You know, basically just salary increases have to factor in, you know, not only productivity increases and CPI changes and so on, but also individual merit increases, promotions and so on, which tends to happen a bit more at the earlier ages than the later ages. We did caveat this by saying we only recommend changing the salary scale if we also change the investment return assumption from 8% to 7.5%, which I know you all have been considering. And that's more of a political thing. It just, if you were to salary scale and investment return are very much offsetting, okay? And if you were to just lower the salary scale, which is going to save costs, reduce costs, and leave the investment return alone at 8%, you know, some would look at that and say that, you know, that's not logical. Those, the same pressures are affecting both, and they ought to be, you know, more in step with each other. So I just wouldn't want anybody, and I've had other clients, several other clients this year that weren't ready to lower their investment assumption, and even though they had this same pattern of lower salary increases the last 5 years, we strongly recommended and they agreed to not change that either for those kinds of reasons. It's saving, you know, being conservative. If you don't change, if you're not going to change investment return, then you shouldn't change the salary assumption either. But we're anticipating, I guess, or you're going to be making that final decision. And so we costed the impact of this new salary scale along with the investment return assumption. And so if you look at page 11, you'll see that those two changes together, changing investment from 8 to 7.5 and going with the recommended salary scale there that averages out 3.8, only had an $8,000 impact on the contribution.
Okay. You have the component elements?
Yes, the next page is a copy of the report that we provided the county last spring. I didn't present this. I think I just provided this to Susie, and I assume she provided it to you. But there you can see the annual required contribution. If you went from 8% all the way down to 7.5, that would increase the annual required contribution $478,000. So in this case, the assumptions are very much offsetting. And, I mean, if you were so inclined, you could even go with this salary change and decrease the investment return even more than 7.5, you know, be even more conservative in that regard if you were already prepared to have a cost increase. Could even go a little bit further. Okay. Page 8, the next assumption. See, I said these would be getting easier, right? The next assumption was the COLAs, the increase that you all authorize each year. We have here the history. For this assumption, we went back. Gina was able to provide this data back to 1998. And you see here that I've looked at the average for the last 5 years, the last 10 years, for all the years shown. And in all three cases, those numbers have been less than the assumption, which has been a flat 2%. So that's been another element of conservatism in your funding of the pension plan. We're recommending that you go to 1.25. I know there was also some interest or discussion, I guess, that Gina conveyed to me about possibly going with 1%. I think when you kind of look at these numbers, I think it's a little bit easier to defend 1.25. For instance, that's what you almost exactly what you've averaged for the last 5 years, and not too different from the last 10 years. But you really only get down to 1% if you look at all, whatever that is, 15 years there. So again, you know, you've been conservative with the 2%. Why not stay a little bit conservative and go with the 1.25? That was our first recommendation. If you really wanted to go with one, just a straight 1%, I would be okay with that. But what we costed for you was the 1.25.
How are COLAs adjudicated year by year? How is that process done?
In the past, it's usually half of what the employees get as a COLA. So if the employees got 2, pensioners got 1.
Who has a
2%
increase?
Yeah.
With a maximum of
2%.
Well, just off the top of my head, this looks too low to me. The 1.25.
Okay.
Feels a little low to me. Because I'm just looking at the last couple of years.
Well, 2014's not on there, and they didn't get anything in 2014.
Nothing.
Nothing.
And keep in mind, this particular assumption is very much a long-term assumption. It has the greatest weight based on people that are close to retirement, of course. But as an assumption, we're assuming 2% COLAs even for the 30-year-olds, that once they retire, they're going to get a COLA of whatever percent is being assumed. And it works as a pretty much a direct offset to the investment return. Increasing the COLA 1% is like decreasing the investment return 1%, at least with respect to the discount during the period of retirement. Obviously not for the discount during the active working career, because there's no COLA then. But for the post-retirement period, it's analogous to changing the investment return in the opposite direction. And you can sort of see that on page 11, going from 2% to 1.25% would reduce the annual required contribution by $409,000. And we can approximate that. If you went to 1.5%, that would be about 2/3 of that. So I guess that would be about 280,000, 270,000.
Yeah, but I was reading this. I didn't know what to think. On the one hand, in private industry, it's unusual to see COLAs in pensions. So if you would have argued for zero, I might have said, great, that represents a change in policy more toward the private sector. So in that respect, great. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, when I look at the most recent data here, 2012 and 2013, I looked at that and thought, well, 1.25% seemed too low. So I'm not sure what I'm thinking, but clearly I'm confused about the 1.25%.
If like 1.25% would mean employees would get a 2.5% COLA, basically,
yeah,
the way it's structured now. So I mean, that's probably, what was the COLA this year?
We didn't get a COLA, but we got a 2% bonus.
Okay, so
yeah,
right, basically 2%. So if the pensioners got, you know, they would have got 1%. And I don't know. I don't think. I kind of think it's. I sort of think it's kind of reasonable, given the recent history. Because go to 2%, for the pensioners to get a 2% COLA, the employees will have to get 4%. And
I think it's good to keep the COLA
right away.
I think it's good to keep the COLA up, and we've got that 2% cap on there. I mean, I've read the news journal over the years. DuPont pensioners saying they haven't got a COLA in, what, 10 years or something. Their purchasing power is diminished, you know. It's not too onerous. I mean, it's pointed out here to, you know, have a modest COLA. Mm-hmm. Well, didn't do one last year. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just thinking on page 7, we were saying that, you know, salary increases were recommending 3.8%. So am I thinking correctly in backing into a pension COLA then of 1.4% coinciding with that?
The salary increases are more than just CPI, because they're supposed to also reflect the individual employee's progression, merit increases, promotional, that sort of thing over his career.
Mm-hmm.
So it's salary scale. CPI is certainly a part of the salary increase, just like it's a part of the investment return, but it's not all of it.
I get something to say.
Mark, on that page 7, under your recommended for the, I'll say, the people who are 60 and older, you have 3% recommended. Would that be more reflective of what you think just the salary increase would be without
Mr. Schoen, if you can come up to the, so that we can record your question. Thank you.
Just more of a question. On page 7, under the recommended, you have 3% for the, you know, I'll say the ones that are starting at, what, 56 and older. Is that more reflective of ones who wouldn't necessarily have promotion, but just that would be a general salary increase?
Right.
And if that was the general salary increase of 3%, if that's your expectation, would then 1.5 be more reflective of the COLAs in the future if this is what's expected here? Yeah. Or is that still a little apples and oranges?
I think that there is, in most theory about this, salary increases really have three components. They have changes in the cost of living. They have productivity gains. You know, the general working population is getting more efficient, and therefore they get increased salary because they're more productive. And then the third component would be the individual merit increases, promotions, and so on. So I think even the where we're looking at 3%, presumably there, that's mostly cost of living, but also productivity gains. So I don't think you necessarily have to say it's all cost of living.
Yeah, I guess the question then would be, if we're projecting long-term going forward that the average salary increase without promotions is 3%, and if COLA for pensioners has been half of what that average is, am I thinking this through clearly, then that would yield a 1.5 pension COLA assumption.
That is correct with your assumption. I don't know if we can assume that employees would get a 3% COLA. As with just with the last budget, it was tough to get a 2% bonus. So with times have changed, and I think looking on history over the years with the economy going up and down, you can see in the good years the most that we're consistently getting 1.5 at that point. But just in this year, we couldn't justify the COLA for the pensioners. So it's hard. I think history is the best thing to go by at this point, and maybe looking at 10 years with the economy going up and down, maybe 5 years isn't the best thing to look at because of the way the economy was the last 5 years, but maybe spreading it out over 10 years and maybe looking at the 1.36 or maybe 1.4 is probably the best way to look at this, which is very close to the 1.5.
Well, you're a lot closer to it than I. I'm just, you know, asking questions from the standpoint of not being, you know, as deep into it as
right,
you.
Right.
So I'm going to rely on your recommendations, too. But this just sort of jumped out at me as being inconsistent.
Okay. The next assumption.
I have a thought or two on the COLA too. That is, your pension plan is very different than most of them that have COLAs, because most of them it's automatic, it's built into the plan. We don't even have an assumption, because they automatically get 3% a year or 2% a year or whatever it is. So your approach has been, I think, a very sound approach. You have provided it, but it's more of on an ad hoc basis. Nobody can say they have an automatic right to it. But you fund it with an assumption that there's going to be some COLA, the 2% assumption that you've used in the past. A lot of the plans that don't have COLAs but occasionally give an ad hoc increase don't fund it till it's actually awarded. So yeah, you know, I should pat yourselves on the back on this one. This is another example of where your approach has been the most conservative, the sound approach, compared to those two extremes that are out there, the pension plans that have already automatically promised a fixed COLA, and they tend to be more poorly funded than yours is, or the ones that don't fund it till they actually give it, and they tend to be more poorly funded as well.
I think you can be relatively certain that we will pay our pensions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right? That's a, you know, as far as even with the, you know, with the funding, you know, I think what we're doing, I think, is the way to go. You know, being very conservative, not promising what you can't deliver, you know, down the road.
All right, well, something to think about there and make some conclusions. The next assumption that we looked at is the marital assumptions. There's really two there. We generally don't have data about spouses, and so an assumption is typically made. Both as to how, you know, what percentage of members are married and what their age difference is. Age difference, usually the male, typically, or at least on average, male spouses tend to be older than female spouses. 3 years is a very common assumption, which is what you had before, a three-year age difference there. But it looked like, when we actually got a hold of the data here, it looked like, at least in your situation, 1 year is more typical. That's not a big cost impact factor. But definitely, the percent married, big difference between the assumption of 100% and what we were actually able to identify in the data. Now, most plans, when they provide the joint and 50% survivor to the spouse, the pension benefit is reduced so that it's either an actuarially equivalent benefit or only partially subsidized benefit. Your plan, as you know, provides that spouse's benefit automatically. No adjustment, you know, whatever the multiplier in the pension works out to be for the single employee. The married employee gets that same pension, but there's a survivor benefit of 50% if the member dies first. So that's called a fully subsidized joint and survivor benefit, which is, you know, a nice benefit that you provide. But it also means that this assumption has a whole lot more impact for your plan than it does for most pension plans. And this was another nice example of where you were approaching this very conservatively in the past by assuming that 100% of the people were married and funding accordingly. When this assumption was made, I don't know for sure, but I've kind of put this together. My suspicion was that you were not able to provide data on the retired members' spouses. And so it was, in some ways, simplest and conservative to just assume 3 years age difference and that all of them were all of the females were 3 years younger than the males. And if you look in the database that we have, every member, you know, whatever the member's birthday is, the spouse is either 3 years later exactly or 3 years earlier, depending upon the sex. It turned out when we were working on this experience study that you were able to provide us very good data about actual spouses of the retired members. And that's where we were able to get this data that you see here, 54.9% of them being married. And my recommendation going forward is that instead of having any assumption for the retired people, we actually have used that data that you have in the future and value it according to what the actual marital status and actual spouse's birth date is. And that we'll only be using the assumption, the new assumption here, the 1 year and 65% for the active employees, because there you don't have all of the marital data. You have some data based on people that are covering their spouse in the medical plan, but beyond that, you don't have all that data. So we need an assumption there. So I think, you know, my recommendation is that that's the approach we take going forward. We're going to have better data every year for the retirees, and we'll use this assumption for the actives when we're projecting out what their ultimate pensions are going to be. And if you turn to page 11 again, you'll see that making this assumption change saved $105,000 in the required contribution. And we only made this assumption change for the actives. I didn't change it yet because I would have had to change the whole database, which was beyond the scope of this experience study. But there'll be more savings when we make a similar kind of, when we start using actual data for the retired members. So, you know, I think we probably can expect another, something on the same order of magnitude, 100-some thousand, maybe a little bit less. The last assumption change that we made on page 10, or the last assumption that we looked at, was the payroll growth assumption. And it's maybe not really fair to call this an assumption. I mean, it is an assumption, but it's not used in any way in projecting those benefits for people, for what their retirement pensions are going to be. It's strictly used as part of the methodology for amortizing your unfunded liability. I think we talked about this a little bit when I was here last February. The methodology that your plan has been using is to take whatever the unfunded is as of the valuation date and add to the required contribution an amortization amount that would amortize that unfunded over 30 years, not as a level dollar amount, but as a level, as an increasing percentage, where the increase is this payroll assumption of 3.5%. So it's analogous to, you know, some of those fancy mortgages that were out. I remember back in the 80s when I was trying to buy my first house and the interest rates were through the ceiling and they were having all these different fancy kinds of mortgages where you actually weren't even paying enough to cover the interest in the early years. Your balance, your outstanding principal on your mortgage was actually increasing in the early years. Your amortization method that I just described, where we use 30 years and determine it as an increasing amount, is exactly the same. You're not actually even covering the interest on your unfunded. And it's the one example that you all have. I mean, we've been talking about how admirable your conservative approach is to everything. You are the most extreme in the other direction on this one thing. the funding of the unfunded liability. It's acceptable, but you're at the end of what's accepted in the industry out there.
Why is that again? I'm sorry.
Why is it? It's because basically you're not funding it. You're unfunded at all. You're making the methodology, the spreading it, you know, as a not as a level dollar amount where you would cover some of the interest and also reduce the principal. When you spread it as an increasing amortization over 30 years, the first year's payment is so small it doesn't even cover the interest. It's only like 3 or 4% of the unfunded amount. That is, doesn't even cover your 8% interest.
I thought we were like spreading differences every 5 years.
No. 8 years.
Doing this, we were never going to be completely funded, then were we?
Yeah, you're basically presuming that investment returns are going to
cover that
eventually get rid of your unfunded.
Yeah.
But every year, the methodology is start with a new 30-year period and do a new calculation on for what that unfunded is. Hmm. So you're keeping kind of a cap on it because you're paying something toward the interest, but you're not even really paying all of the interest. It's just kind of a...
That wasn't known.
Just kind of...
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I figured it was all computed in. And
Well, you're not the only one that does it. Like I say, it is out there, but it definitely defines that extreme. I have some clients that... that'll use 30 years and have an increasing amount, but they don't start over every year, okay? So the second year, they do have a higher amortization amount, and the next year, they have a higher amortization amount.
The actual amount.
The actual amount. So they have, instead of yours is an open period, meaning you restart the 30 years. All of my other clients that have an increasing amount have a closed period where it declines. Now, every time they have a gain or a loss or a plan improvement, they have a new component that starts over at 30 years. But basically, they are funding the unfunded to some degree. They're not as well funded as you are, but they theoretically are. Really? And then I have other plans that they don't do it on an increasing percentage. They don't do it based on 3.5 payroll increase assumption, they do it on a level dollar. So even in the first year, they clearly are, in that case, funding more than just the interest. They're making a payment towards principal. And they'll use a closed period so that they don't start over every year, and they'll use a level amortization method.
I thought like if we say the plan had a very good year this year, and our investments did very well, better than 8%. They made 10%. I thought then that 2% extra gain was kind of smoothed out over 5 years or 8 years.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Or loss, whatever it is. Okay. But then basically you're saying the 30-year amortization keeps rolling over for the base of the plan?
Yeah, whatever, we look at whatever those smoothed assets are. They're smoothed over a five-year period. And those assets are compared to the actuarial accrued liability. Okay? Whatever that difference is the unfunded. Now, you go back a few years, that difference was zero. It was negative. The assets exceeded that. Okay? But in any year where it doesn't, where there isn't, an actual unfunded amount, whatever that amount is spread over 30 years with an increasing amortization so that in actuality you fund something toward the interest on that, but nothing on the principal.
It's like refinancing your loan every year.
Yes.
You take out a new 30-year loan each year. Is that a fair?
Yeah, that's exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's really imperative that we correct this, don't you think? I mean, this is something that's a long-term problem. It's not going to, unless we have spectacular returns, you know, we're always going to be behind the curve.
That is correct. Mr. Lessel and I had talked about this prior to that, and it is extremely important that we, at this point, look at this and change this.
Yeah. In balance, like I say, this is the one thing that your approach has been not conservative, but aggressive, okay? And all the other things you're so conservative on, and that's why you're in a good position. So I can't really, I mean, I'm not faulting you on this or anything like that, but I did want to make sure that you understood it. And as I say, on page 10, you know, looking at the last few years, we certainly, in the last 5 years, can't support a 3.5% increase. We're not really defending it so much on past experience. We're sort of defending it as a methodology for funding the plan. And so, I mean, if you wanted to go to zero, you know, and do a level dollar amount and be able to say, okay, we're funding part of that principal every year, you could do that too. You don't have to have past experience to justify a 0% assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. For purposes of this study, I said, well, maybe we'll move in a more conservative direction. Let's try seeing what the impact of 2.5% is instead of 3.5%. And on page 11, you'll see that payroll growth assumption had just under $75,000 impact of going from 3.5 to 2.5. And if you did want to go all the way down to zero, you know, it would be, what, I guess 1.5 times that? So it would be a total of $200,000 impact.
That's because it's spread over 30 years. It's not a big hit, so to speak.
I mean, yeah, you're still spreading it. You're still, I mean, the hope still is that, you know, ultimately the assets will recover from the downturn they've had in the last number of years. And you know, certainly in the history of your plan, there was times when your unfunded went away completely. You completely covered it. It's just a question of what are you going to do in the years when it's down? How aggressive or conservative do you want to be there?
Well, I think we're all mindful that, with new rules, this unfunded portion is going to be more clearly displayed.
Correct.
For public acclaim, and that it would be important for us if there were to be an unfunded liability, mm-hmm. for us to be able to have a clear way of saying we have a method to reduce and or eliminate the unfunded over a reasonable period of time.
Right.
And so this is where this aspect, you know, maybe takes on more importance than it might otherwise take on.
Right, exactly. When Mr. Lessel and I talked about it, I think we should have a goal to make it fully funded and to have this rolling 30 years or what we've done, even to have a 2.5% that I was even thinking going to the 0% because we need to have that definitive period that our plan is in 30 years we will be fully funded. And, you know, that there is, we're not constantly adjusting it every year.
Yeah, so you'd want to go from an open to a closed period,
mm-hmm.
where you would
Correct.
Not start over right. every year. Right.
As Hugh points out, this will soon be in the audit report, you know, and plus there for everyone to see, and then also would have somewhat an effect on the bond rating. I mean, you know, that'll be seen. So, I mean, I think it's an investment, you know, to have a, you know, for a better bond rating in the future, too, that That'd be one aspect that we could improve. You know, that would help.
Okay, well, to kind of wrap up my presentation, back on page 11, the bottom line is the impact of making all of these assumption changes. And the net impact was $183,000 savings in the annual required contribution. And remember, that's not, we're still expecting another $100,000 something on the order once we start using actual retiree spouse data.
Yes.
So we've got that on top of that. Yeah, I would say you could definitely afford going to a more conservative amortization method.
I like that we're going to real-world figures. I mean, you have to have assumptions going out, but I mean, but to use data that's confirmed and we know is accurate, you know, as your basis, I think that's good that we're doing that. And, you know.
Now, if we change the retirement like we talked about, that's going to go in the other direction a bit. So.
Yes. Yeah.
And to help with some of these assumptions, it is my plan to have an experience study done every 5 years. So if we were to base it off of the history, just like we did with the salary scale, things like that, we would look again at it in 5 years, and we would adjust it at that time.
Yeah, I guess that, this was never done.
We were sort of, I don't think anyone thought that, you know, we weren't fully funding or, you know, as far as the salary, if the wage it increases each year, no one understood that to be the case, I'm sure. I mean, so this is a great revelation, I'll tell you, to learn that. It's good. We can do a better job funding our pension.
I think this is all very helpful, and to have these assumptions be exposed. And I would just say that this this whole issue of amortizing the unfunded amount in a realistic period of time is really going to be a key issue.
Absolutely.
And so I would encourage, you know, we've talked about going to 0%. I'd encourage considering a range of options that might even go a little further than that. If for instance, if the general public heard, oh yeah, we have an unfunded liability and we have a plan to eliminate it in 30 years, to me, that sounds, you don't have a plan. So I would just say, if it's affordable, even if it's not affordable, we should probably look to see if there might be a more aggressive way of addressing the unfunded liability.
And we do, if we have surpluses or things like that, we do make that recommendation to fund the pension to help that. Knowing that our goal is 30, but we do want to encourage to bring that down as we can, because it does help with our short-term budgets as well once we keep bringing that down. Sure. So it is, it's a huge thing.
I didn't include it in here, but if you look in the actuary's report, there's a comparison of the required contribution with what you've actually contributed. And you look down that, and again, there's like a high percentage of the number of years you contributed more than your required contribution. I have some clients where they're always exactly the same, you know. They never contribute one penny more than.
Well, the issue was when after 2008, we really couldn't afford to contribute to the minimum then, but maybe now we gradually improve, we can afford to up it a little bit.
Some pension plans back when things were roaring, they wouldn't do their minimum, as it was pointed out, because they, you know, as far as the pension was doing great, but that doesn't last forever. We know that, and then later on down the road, they came to regret it. You know what I mean? So I'm glad that we keep our commitments, you know, as much as we can.
There's one state that their stated funding policy is to fund 50% of what the actuary tells them is the minimum required.
Yeah.
Automatically, 50%. It's either Illinois or New Jersey. I think it's Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And just to add to the conversation about the rate of return, there was a letter from Mr. Schoen making the recommendation of 7.5%. And behind that in your packet, I found a study when I was doing some research, and it shows that most governments have stated 8%, however they're making that transition. And it lists all the states and their pensions and where they are currently. The state of Delaware is at 7.5. Our auditors are making the recommendation as well to go to 7.5 because some of our money is funded in that pension fund. So we should probably follow what the state has done since that's where our money is invested. But you can see where the states are and the study that just was completed last month.
I'll just clarify that what I attempted to say was not a specific recommendation, but our observation based upon the asset allocation mix that you use and your conservative nature of how you like to invest, we would like to see it down to no more than 7.5%.
So that's good.
It's a slight modification.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're not a lawyer, are you? You've
been around the track.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
that's right.
You all have
yeah.
to be lawyers these days.
This is very enlightening, what you presented. It's great to see.
As Mr. Lessel has mentioned, we do want to take some of these assumptions and add it to the 2014 report that's coming out. So I would like to get a consensus or take a vote from your members to see where you would like some of these assumptions changed, or we can just go right down the line. The retirement assumption that he is, Mr. Lessel has made includes the early retirement, or does not include the RO that we had offered. Does anybody have a motion or recommendation on that assumption? Should we take his recommendation? Should we ask him to go back and report back to me, and then I follow through with the recommendation to council? The council meeting I'd like to take this to is on December 10th to give them time to do their report in January.
Would it be a good idea to get the slightly revised figures?
Okay. And I can share that with the members of the committee once that he has those revised figures for retirement.
Kind of, you know, we talked about maybe also trying to reduce this this unfunded liability. And I'm wondering if we're going to try to address that here too.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be part of the payroll growth.
Okay.
That's
okay.
Where that
yeah,
is.
That's fine. Yeah. I think it'll be a good thing to look at it then.
Okay. The termination assumption, do I have a motion to accept his recommendation to adjust the termination scale as presented by Mr. Lessel?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. Any questions on the motion? Mr. James?
Vote aye.
Mr. Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Aye.
And I vote aye. Motion passed. Okay, the next assumption, flipping back through these pages. Okay, then we have the salary scale and the investment rate as a combination. As he said, that you would want to adjust both of them together. The investment rate is the largest change that we are going to see and make. Do I have a motion to change that and a percentage?
So moved.
Okay. Motion and second. Okay, to change the investment rate to 7.5% and also adjust the salary scale. Okay, Mr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
And I vote yes. Motion carried. Okay, the next one is the COLA at 1.25%. Listen to Mr. Leahy's concerns, and looking at the data, I think 1.4% would be a good number, knowing the fact that this study would be done every 5 years, and we could adjust it at that point. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
I have a motion. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. Baker. Any questions? Okay. Mr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
And I vote yes. Motion carried. And the next one is the marital status, which is the actual figures given by the HR department. Do I have a motion for the recommendation?
So moved.
Okay, Mr. Leahy?
Second.
Second by Mr. Baker. Any questions on the motion? Okay, Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
I think it's more popular. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
Okay, I vote yes. Motion carried.
Nancy's going crazy on that one.
And then the last one now, where we're talking about the payroll growth and the effect of the amortization. The recommendation is to lower it to 2.5%. Do I have a motion or a recommendation at this point? This is the one that could change it right now. We could lower it to 0%. We could, what is the pleasure of the committee?
There was discussion at 0%. I think 0% would be more conservative, and there was also discussion about a range of recommendations that you and John could be discussing. So I would really like to leave that into your hands.
Okay.
To come up with a best way to approach this, knowing that the payroll growth assumption of 2.5% is really not what we're after.
I think it resolves the problem between what Hugh proposes. And I mean, it's realistic. I mean, we're not being, making this up out of whole cloth. I mean, it's needed, I think.
Okay. So let me clarify. So the recommendation is the 2.5%, knowing that we'll go in and look at it and how we can bring that down quicker. Or do you want to do this? Is the recommendation 0%?
I can live with that if so long as we all agree that we're really aiming toward something that has the effect of 0%.
Okay.
Or even more conservative than that.
Okay.
Can I comment? Yeah. if you are just shortening the period but still leaving it at 2.5%, you're still not covering the interest in the earlier years, so you're not really making the kind of progress I think that you're talking about there. So in other words, if what I'm hearing from you is saying that you want something where you can actually show that we're reducing the principal, then we need to go to, probably go to zero. You're not going to solve that problem by shortening the period. It's just a shorter mortgage with the same issue.
I mean, I'm comfortable with the 0%.
How realistic is that? I mean, to go to zero, what would be the impact to going to zero on these numbers, from like the annual contract?
Instead of, I was saying it would be something on the order of 200,000 instead of the 75.
There. Yeah, 125,000 difference.
It's not.
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, it's cheap. I don't know. Mr. Lawson, he's the one who's got to.
He's got to take the budget in. That's the hard part.
We want to remain realistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the assumptions will still net close to zero with increasing that to the 125, or the 0%. So I think overall, we're just adjusting everything. Our net effect is going to end up being zero.
Pretty close.
Yep.
So I would move a payroll growth assumption of 0% and leave it open to the idea that if you and John come up with something equivalent but a better way at it,
okay,
that would be acceptable as well.
As long as the shortfall is covered, or as far as, you know, mathematically covered, and the, you know.
Okay, I have a motion to lower the current assumption to zero for the payroll growth. Do I have a second?
Second.
And
I also think it'd be good to look at other options if there are sufficient funds, overages, whatever, and revenue, whatever, that might become available to help fund it.
Okay, are there any questions on the motion? Okay, we'll take a vote. Mr. James?
Yes.
Mr. Baker?
Yes.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
And I vote yes, motion carried. I think that covers the assumptions. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Very good, appreciate it.
Okay, moving on. We have our performance reports from Pierce Park Group.
And I would also, okay, so that'll be item three, and then I would suggest just a slight change in the order. I would go make item five, item four,
okay,
item six, item five, and if time permits, item four becomes item six. Okay, so we took the proposal part and dropped it down to the bottom, and if we get to that, we get to that.
The policy statement update, I'm just going to explain what it is, and we're not going to discuss it until next meeting. So
okay, good.
That's just to sum it all up.
Okay, so go to the bound report. Okay. I will give in there you'll see two pages. One's our newsletter. The other is an update through October on the OPEB fund. I will give you the brief version, and you can choose to ask for more if you so choose. But so here's the bottom line. Stock markets did very, very well in third quarter. They've done very well this year. They've done far better than any of us expected, okay? Bond markets have been slightly negative. That was to be expected, and it was expected that interest rates would go up. We didn't know when or how much, and we don't know how much more and how long, but, you know, as low as interest rates are, you should expect, you know, that interest rates will eventually revert to the mean, whether that's 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, I couldn't tell you. So, but that's why you have a rebalancing policy. It's why you manage your bonds conservatively. It's why you have a laddered bond approach to some degree with Wilmington Trust to help protect you in rising interest rate environment. If you go to page one in the tab, you'll see just a couple of pieces on the overall economy. The federal deficit, believe it or not, has been going down as a percentage of the GDP, but it was still 4% of the GDP as of the end of for this year. What you call the job separation rate is an issue of looking at. It's not just what the unemployment is. It's what are people doing if they're not employed? Are they actually, did they quit or were they laid off? Okay, and we're seeing the quit rate increasing, which is actually a positive sign. People are more likely to say, okay, I'm going to quit and go look for another job. We haven't seen that since almost a decade ago. Okay, page two, you'll see the average hourly earnings growth rate, although positive, is below historic norm. So that is a concern. If people aren't keeping up salary-wise, that then consumption is going to eventually decrease, and or people will borrow against their savings, which is, we saw what happened, people borrow too much and the government borrows too much. And then the real personal consumption expenditure rate had dropped down dramatically at 2008, so it bounced back up and now it's right around historic norms, okay? Now, on to page three, you'll see, and this is as of the end of September. October even made these stories even better. The gray is the year-to-date returns, and the blue is the quarterly returns. U.S. equities, as of the end of September, were up 20% for the year. as I say, none of us expected that. International was positive, but not quite as positive, 14.7. That does not include emerging markets. And emerging markets, which are usually the darling when you have a strong economy, well, I shouldn't say the economy strong, when you have strong equity markets, usually it's the emerging markets that do better. They actually have been negative year to date. Okay? Bonds, as you can see, U.S. bonds down for the year, down at 2%. That's not yours specifically, but that's the aggregate bond index. That's, think of it as an overall investment grade bonds in the U.S. Okay? High yield bonds up 3.7 year to date, 2.3 for the quarter. They tend to follow what stocks do. You know, if people think the economy is getting better, stocks should do better. Also, high yield bonds, another word for those are junk bonds. You always hear me kid about that, but that's what they are. They tend to do better when equities do better, but worse when they don't. You do not have any exposure in junk bonds, other than you might, and I'm not sure this, you might have a little bit through what the state does, but through what Wilmington Trust does, it's all investment grade. Okay? And international bonds have also been negative, as well as emerging markets. Inflation-sensitive investments have been strongly negative for the year. That doesn't mean we haven't had some inflation, but our inflation expectations actually have dropped down, gotten lower than they were at the beginning of the year. So those areas haven't done as well. Again, at least through your OPEB fund and what you don't have through the state, you do not have exposure, I'll say direct exposures into those areas. Okay. Page 4, summarizing it, small cap stocks did the best, but of all of them, on average up 27, almost 28%, mid cap 24, and large cap 21%. That's a normal story you'd see when you have really strong markets. The smaller end of the market does better. Typically, when it goes the other way, the larger stocks are the ones that protect better. Go on to page tab 2. Go to your pension. You'll see page 9. Third quarter gain was $2.4 million. Year to date is $6.6 million. That's a 4.2% gross return as the end of third quarter, and year to date 11.7%. Okay. Just, you know, your OPEB fund was up almost another 3% in October. So if you said it was about that for the pension fund also, that means your pension, I'd approximate, is up 14 to 14.5% so far this year. Okay? Nice numbers.
Yeah.
Looking ahead, number one thing on my list was actuarial return assumptions. Very pleased to see that you've dropped it down to 7.5. At some point in time, you might even want to consider dropping it to 7.25. But as you drop your return assumptions, your liabilities go up and your ARCs go up. What's nice is by study that you've done, you found some mechanisms that would lower your ARC, and you could offset that with decreasing your return assumptions. As you drop that hurdle rate, then it's easier to get to it each year. It's going to be very tough to get that 8% every year. Although you've done it since 2008, almost every year, and consistently been above that, that's not a good long-term assumption to use. It's been extraordinarily good for the last 4 years, okay? And then the other thing is investing the ARC. So your contribution is going to come in. We're going to touch on that in a minute. You'll see a little different format in our reports now. We put a little bit more at the total fund level and trim back when we get to the individual managers instead of 4 pages, just diluting you, you're giving you so much detail, we've narrowed those down to 2, the key points. You can see the chart on page 11 shows the dollar value of your portfolio, and the gray part just shows your net cash flows in and outs. Okay? At page 12, same thing on page 11, as of the end of September, the pension fund was $62.5 million, 12.5% 1 year return. That's not a year-to-date, but 1 year, meaning October 1st to September 30th. Go to page 13, a new page. We really like this page. It shows you graphically what your allocations are to the different areas. So you can see over time. Now, this so far is only 7 quarters, but this will keep rolling on out. You can see, you know, how much you've had allocated to domestic equities, global equities, fixed income, cash, and the state pool. Page 14, some rankings, give you some idea. On for the quarter, pension fund had a 4.2% return. It's ranked in the 73rd percentile. That's a third quartile. We would expect a more conservatively run portfolio at times when things do better would be a little bit less than average. And yours is a little bit below average for the, for the quarter. The year-to-date ranking is in the 21st percentile. It's the top 21% of all the public funds in the universe that we subscribe to, which I'm very, very happy about that, because when you consider that yours is more conservatively invested than the average, and yet you are in the top 21% nationally, that's a very good place to be. In a moment, I'll speak of why I think that has occurred. For the 1 year, you can see 12.5, 36th percentile in 3 years, and you're top 30th percentile. Okay. Now, why, if you're more conservatively invested at a time that the average, the more aggressively invested funds did better, meaning the ones had more stocks, why did you do so well? A couple reasons. Even though you have a lower allocation to equities, the type of equities you're invested in are more conservative than other types of funds. So it's an interesting situation here. It paid to be more aggressive, mean more in equities, but you're better off in being more conservative equities. The funds that were in hedge funds, private equities, a lot of these other, you know, more derivative type products are the ones that have not done as well. Those things have come to home to roost, I think, to a lot of them. Okay. Do you have some exposure through that, through the state pool? Yes, you do. But you're also part of a very, I forget what it is now, $3-5 billion pool. That to have an exposure into that area, some of those areas, in that kind of mechanism, I'm comfortable with. It's not a big allocation of your funds, but it's part of it. Also, your allocation to international equities is less than the average public fund out there. The average public fund is about 18%. Our other clients who have a 60% target for equities are at 14%, and you're at 12%. Well, if you remember a couple pages before, I said it was better to be more in U.S. equities than international. The U.S. did better than international. So your underweighting to international relative to a peer group was beneficial to you. Okay? Now, having said that, I will tell you, I would actually like to see you consider moving your international targets from 12 to 14. Slight move up. You might say, Michael, why would you say that? Didn't you just show us that domestic did better than international? Yes, it's happened to so far this year. But the U.S. is about 50% of the overall world market. Your allocation is 48-12, meaning you're 80% U.S., 12% international. Okay? I will also tell you that international is a little bit more volatile than domestic. So it's a trade-off. You know, do you inch your way up with a little bit more in international, which hopefully I think in time might give you a little bit more return, but add a little bit more volatility to your portfolio. Most times I wouldn't suggest clients do it, but as I was telling Gina before, until last Thursday, you were the most conservative public fund client that we have, and we have probably about 20 public fund clients. We just got hired by a county out in western Pennsylvania. They're actually even a little bit more conservative than yourselves. But even in the meeting, in the presentation, when they hired us, they said they thought maybe they were just maybe a little too conservative. You know, they said, how would you rank us? I said, well, a 1 to 5, where 1 is conservative and 5 is aggressive, you're a 1. And they said, well, maybe they might need to be a 2 or 2.5. So you might want to think about it. If you're comfortable with where you are now, leave it as is. But I want to plant a seed there that maybe a little more allocation to international might be something to consider. Okay? Page 17, I will note that, you know, your expense ratio is 0.59%. That is higher than all the rest of our public funds, but it's because of the state pool. The state pool has done very well for you, but because of the types of other instruments they invest in, the private equities and some of these other things, their expense ratio is quite a bit higher than, I shouldn't say quite a bit higher, it's higher than what we see for our other clients. Our other clients, on their funds, they're about 33 to 35 basis points. You're at 59, okay? But, and that's because of the state piece of it, but the state's pool has done enough additional return to offset the additional cost. Do you want me to go any deeper on this, or is that because I'd be glad to, but I yeah,
that's
just,
good.
No, okay.
That's good.
Okay. So now let's go over to the should we go to the OPEB fund, then talk about our allocations?
Yes,
for both
please.
Them together. Okay. So go to the next tab. Okay, so that's the OPEB fund. You'll see, for the third quarter, your return was $1.1 million, and that's net. That's net of all your, that's net of your investment expenses. Okay, does not include your custodial fee. It doesn't include our fee, but it's net of all investment expenses. Year-to-date, $2.5 million. Third quarter return, 4.4, so actually this was better than the pension. Year-to-date is 10.3, which is less than the pension. Okay, very low investment manager fees. I'll show you that in a minute. Looking ahead, first thing I said was actuarial return assumptions, then consider increasing the international target from 12 to 14. You might want to consider some additional further international equity diversification and more active large cap stock diversification. You've made a couple changes, but I'd like to see one way or another that we diversify this some more. Okay. And then investing your 2013 ARC. Page 35, again, you see the cash flows, you see the returns, you can see the year-to-date return 10.3, 1 year 11.4, 2 years 12%, and that's 12% per annum, per year. Okay. You see the cash flows on 36 for each of the individual managers, where money got moved. You know, if you recall, you terminate BlackRock equity dividend and move that money into two other different equity portfolios. Page 37, see the graph on the bottom showing the allocations, plus up top where we, you know, show you what your asset allocation, and are you within the ranges as permitted by the investment policy statement. Page 38, see your rankings again, 63rd percentile for the quarter, 44th year to date, so above average, even with a very conservative. This pool is managed even more conservatively than the state, because you don't have some of the type of investments that the state has, than the pension, because you don't have some of the type of investment that the state pool has in them. The 1 year ranking 57th percentile, and two rankings the 80th percentile. Okay. Why don't I take you over to page 42? I'm not trying to go too fast for you, but I know you've been here for a while, so if you want more, you please ask for it. Page 42, you'll see the expense ratio on this is 32 basis points. So it's just a touch over half of what you are on the pension fund. Okay. These returns in the rankings we show you are gross rates of return. So actually, if you were comparing the pension and the other, you'd actually, if the two of them showed the same return, then the OPEB actually was 30 basis points better than the pension, because we're showing you gross returns. We show the rankings. Okay. Okay. You know, do you want more? Or is that enough?
That is good.
Okay. You'll also see the one page. Through the end of October, 2.7% return, so that means the year-to-date return is 13%, and the fund was over almost $28 million. Now, at this point, these recommendations for changes in assumed rate of returns were just for the pension, not for the OPEB, is that correct?
We probably should talk about that, but that's okay. Actually.
That's not your
certification. That's Mike's.
Okay. So I will just observe that your asset allocation and your manager lineup in the OPEB fund is actually more conservative than the pension. So if you lowered the one down to 7.5, that might be a consideration you'd want to do for the OPEB also.
contribution.
Thank you. To lower the OPEB to 7.5%, I guess, would you suggest another study so that it's not...
I was going to talk to Michael Schooley from him to see what I can do with this study and how it would play into the OPEB.
Okay. Onto this page, Gina?
Yes.
Okay. So look at the one that says that Sussex County pension. You'll see that the values, market values as of November 11th, other than the state, because we just only had theirs through the end of September, okay? But what we do is, since the state's targeted asset allocation mix is 60-40, yours is 60-40, we look to have the rest of the pieces to be 60-40 between stocks and bonds, okay? Right now, if you look at the, say, under current allocation, between the domestic equities at 26% and the fixed income at 11.5%, that's over a 70-30 split between the two. So we wanted to bring those back as close as reasonable to the 60-40 split between your domestic equity and your fixed income, not including the state pool. Of the $3,087,012 that are going in the ARC, we were suggesting to give that to Wilmington Trust. But Wilmington Trust would manage this differently than what they're managing the rest. And talking of that $3 million, all but roughly $150,000 is going to be paid back out next year, during the course of the year, in benefit payments. So it doesn't really make sense to invest that in, you know, a portfolio that has an average duration of 4 years. What you've done in the past is one of two things, is either you had to sit in a money market for a year, or you bought short-term treasuries, like laddered out 3, 6, 9, 12 months. I talked to Don Duramo, this morning, who's the fixed income manager on Wilmington Trust portfolio. And what he suggested, and it seems to me to make sense, is that this portfolio would go to them. They would go buy the treasuries for you. They would not charge you an investment management fee for that, and all they would charge you is a custody fee for that, which is somewhere, he wasn't sure off the top of his head, but somewhere between 3 to 5 basis points. Basically, nothing to hold that. But they would go do that for you, because they said, why put it into the portfolio when you'd have to liquidate it that quickly? And even if they managed it on a short-term basis, if he had to hit you with a 20 basis point fee, which is their fee, it gobbled up most of the return. So I think that was a very, very fair offer on his part to do it that way. And then takes it out of your hands of having to, well, where do you go buy the treasuries and how do you hold them? And, you know, we'll just do all that for you. So if you like that idea, that's what we're putting up there is for what we think would make sense.
So the county is reimbursed once a year?
We do once a year. And what we had done recently is basically it's been either sitting in a CD or a checking account for the year instead of doing that. Mm-hmm. Since our contribution pretty much matches what we give out for the year, is just put it in something small, short term, that could earn a little more than a CD or in our checking account.
Yeah, and he would go buy treasuries is what he'd do with that. So,
sure.
Do I have a motion to make the annual contribution of $3,086,012 to Wilmington Trust to buy treasuries?
One question.
Sure.
150. He said 150,000. Would that be invested elsewhere, or he would just add that to the regular fixed income investments, what you're not using for the reimbursement to the county?
You could do that, although the numbers you gave me were based upon last year's benefit payments.
Yeah, it's an estimate.
So maybe you just have them do all this with treasuries anyway, just to give you a little cushion, you know. And so if he went and invested that other $150,000, you might need to draw on that. So, you know, I would say it's close enough that maybe you just do treasuries with the full amount.
Moved.
Okay. Okay, I have a motion by Mr. Baker. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. James. Any questions on the motion? Okay, Mr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
And I vote yes, motion carried. Okay, and then the OPEB?
OPEB follows the same theory, that your cash outflows are just a little bit, well, last year, based upon last year, was it last year's that you gave me or projected for this year?
It was last year's.
Last year. So, so based upon last year's outflows and the ARC contribution coming in, again, that was about $150,000 difference. You know, so I'd say follow the same format. Is they would do the same thing here, put them in a laddered treasury approach going out 1 year. They'd work with you, Gina, for specific, you know, do you want it quarterly, do you want it monthly, you know, this kind
great,
of thing. So.
Great. Okay. Do I have a motion to do our annual required contribution to Wilmington Trust in the amount of $1,933,752 to buy short-term treasuries?
So moved.
Okay, I have a motion from Mr. Leahy. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Mr. James. Is there any questions on the motion? Okay, we'll take a vote. Mr. James?
Aye.
Mr. Baker?
Aye.
Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
And I vote yes, motion carried. Okay, thank you. And the next item on the agenda, we're going to talk about Pierce Park proposal to actively manage the OPEB funds.
Did you want to do the investment policy statement first? Or do that
no, I'll just end with that. That's going
okay,
to take 2 minutes.
Okay, so I'll just change that word manage for,
okay.
for a moment, if I may. So one of the things that I've observed is, and as we all know, and we've talked about several times, the process when you first move the money into, you know, out of the state pool and into overseeing it yourselves, because of the process that needed to go through it, didn't get to where I think we would have all liked it to be. And you've been taking steps over the last couple of years of, I'll use the term, improving the structure of the portfolio, how it looked, the diversification, things like that. And you can see the improvement in performance since you've been, especially since the last year. But I also observe that, I'd say, other clients of ours who have the same target asset allocation mix, your returns aren't as good as theirs. Okay, and so I'm looking for a mechanism to say, what are the next steps we can do to get it to where, I'd say, I'd call it where your place is good now. I'm never satisfied with good. I want it to be excellent to great. Okay. So there's really one of three approaches I would suggest. One is continue doing things as we're doing them now, but then I'm going to come back to you and suggest several more additions to it. And when I, because of the relationship we have now, I don't come and say, pick this manager, pick this one, this one, this one. Okay. That's a different type of relationship. Okay. Ours is to say, here's three choices here, here's three choices here, here's three, you know. And I would suggest, you know, I would like to see maybe four or five changes, okay? If that mechanism works fine for you, be glad to do it, you know. So that's one approach. The other extreme approach, maybe I don't like the word extreme, but is some clients just say, okay, Pierce Park, you pick the funds we're in. When you think we need to make a change, you make the change. You allocate them in the percentages you want them in, so on and so forth. Every Monday morning, we get together as an investment committee. We go over, we review not only the performances of each of the funds, but we also look at your asset allocation mix. And if you've moved beyond the band of plus or minus 3%, we come back, you know, we would automatically rebalance it back to the targets. Okay? So it's a very hands-on approach. We have two clients that said, we like that, but we still want to make the final decision, okay? But we like the approach where you're monitoring it every week for us. You're making sure we stay within our asset allocation mixes. You're following each of the funds to make sure there isn't any big deterioration in performance or, you know, change in portfolio managers, things like that. And we do like it that you say, here is our best ideas. We hire this one here, we'd hire this one here, we'd hire this one here, we'd fire this one here, and all that, okay? That's a third approach. The second and third approach, quite frankly, we would charge you more money for. It's much more hands-on. It's more work. There's more liability on our part. So I lay those out to you for consideration, but I'd like to see us collectively find one of those approaches that take what's good and make it better.
We're paying 1% of assets now, is that correct, for our current service?
Well, that would be lovely if you
because I don't know. I don't see the bills.
I would do this extra service for free in that case.
Okay.
No,
I didn't know.
0.1%.
0.1.
Yeah.
Oh, 0.1%. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
And we're not suggesting you do this on the pension side, because, in fact, you're really already having that with the state doing that on 60% of your portfolio. They're making those changes as they see fit. Okay?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's just, and the rest of the pieces are fitting together well enough. So I'm only suggesting that you think about that on the OPEB side, that one of these three approaches, and the one is, the first one is still the same as it was before, but I just want to, you know, push it along to make changes at a more expeditious
approach. So right now, your current structure is you come back with maybe three or four different recommendations on whatever foreign global funds, whatever it is you're recommending.
Sure.
And then we pick and choose, like, we like this one or like that one. And the third option would be basically you would handle this on a weekly basis.
Well, the second and third, we would
second option.
We would review it weekly, no matter what. Okay, in either case, the second or third.
Okay.
Quite literally, Monday morning, 9:30, looking over the asset allocation mix, and the asset allocation mix is to make sure that if you want to be at 60% equities, if you've gotten over 63 or below 57, that's our target. That's the range we allow it to go to. If it goes beyond that, we would. And I'm sure two, we would bring it back. Option three, we'd send it to you and say, hey, here's what we think needs to be done. Okay, this is our recommendation. In that case, you'd have, you know, somebody would have authority to say, okay, fine, let's do that. Go ahead, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
So would your fee be different for that? Is that for that service for two or three?
Yes. Yes. So
what would that be?
instead of 10 basis points, it'd be 20 basis points.
Okay. I did know that it was 0.1%. Hopefully not a senior moment.
But again, we don't think you need to do anything on the pension side. It's on the OPEB side. That
your investments, I know right now, I think we're all mutual funds, or except for the Fulton Trust part. I mean, are you suggesting what types of investments would you envision if we went with number two or three?
Okay, so on the bond side, I'd stay exactly where you are. Okay, although eventually, when the portfolio gets large enough, maybe indexing some of that to lower some cost. But basically, I'd leave that to stay on the stock side. Let me just go to your mix for a second. Okay. We'd have probably one more large cap stock, and there's something on the growth side. Right now you have a value and you have a core, but you don't have anything on the growth side. We'd like to see more diversification on the international side. We'd probably have four funds there. Okay. You have two right now. We'd also like to see you go to 14%. Actually, if you stay at 12% international, we'd probably be at three funds. If you go to 14% international, we'd go to four funds. We'd have more diversification in the mid and small cap area also. So right now where you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, we'd probably be at about nine or 10 funds. All institutional, but I say broad and diversification, but that's where we would go with it.
Now, when you at your weekly meetings, you focus on especially rebalancing, given the ups and downs. Do you look at the specific allocations or if you try to anticipate what's going on overseas, or
No, we don't. We don't.
How that would affect our investments?
Yeah, we won't make any tactical decisions like that. So I'd like to. If you said you want to drive, you want us to drive the car at 60 miles an hour, we're going to drive the car at 60 miles an hour. Now, in that we have a global equity manager in there right now, Dodge & Cox, and we would add another one. Those managers are the ones who say, do I like the international better now or like domestic better? Do I see better opportunities in there? So they're going to make some subtle changes, but I'd rather have, quite frankly, the firm that's managing the money being the one saying, do I do a little more allocation to international or domestic? We don't make, we stay right on the discipline.
So you would say to Dodge & Cox or whoever it is, you know, you're in charge or you make recommendations to us on how to invest your portion of the funds. If Dodge & Cox had $1 million allocation, then Dodge & Cox would handle the individual investments?
Yeah. Well, Dodge & Cox would still be a mutual fund. So
okay.
Dodge & Cox
so
is going to manage.
Within the mutual fund.
Yes. In our opinion, for the size portfolio you have in total, that institutional mutual funds are the way to go to get the diversification you need. If you went to separate account managers and, you know, the big shops, especially the ones that go into international and global, if you gave them $1 million or $2 million, they wouldn't accept it. They wouldn't manage a portfolio that size. So to get the big, I'll say the big venerable firms, you know, you'd want to go that route. And yet your cost structure is, they say, is extremely competitive, and it would stay that way.
You know. Would you look at ETFs? Or?
We would not. And the reason why, we might add a little bit of indexing. Actually, you got a fair amount of indexing anyway, so I probably wouldn't index anymore. But ETFs, we see that more as a short-term investment tool, whereas if one's going to have a longer-term position in an index or passive approach, it's less expensive to go into like a Vanguard or a Fidelity index fund, institutional index fund.
Are there any more questions? What's the thoughts of the committee?
I guess I'm still, I understand your second recommendation because you guys would be definitely more actively managing. But with the third, you would like call Gina Monday or Tuesday, whenever, each week and say, we have too much of Dodge & Cox global and we need to rebalance it to, you would... Is that how you envision this?
Well, so three would be, we'd still come back. The first thing we'd do is we'd come back to the committee and say, here's exactly our recommendations as to, since we think you should diversify more, here specifically, we think you should have this fund and this percentage here and this one, this one, this one. So that'd be the first step, I'll say, getting it to where we'd like to see it to be, okay? But instead of us having the authority to do that, you have to approve that, vote it up or down or not, you know, whatever. Then each Monday, we review it. But most of the times when we're sending out, it's just saying, here's your portfolio. We recommend no changes. So the changes we recommend will happen for one of two reasons. One is if you see a huge move in the stock market, either up or down, that you've moved beyond 63% or below 57%, and then we'd send you a rebalance sheet, just like the rebalance we showed you, and here's our recommendation. We suggest we move this, this, and that. Not because we like Dodge & Cox any more or less. It's because, say, stocks have gotten up to 65%. What you don't want to happen, and I like my analogy of driving down the road. Now you're driving down the road, and you're just trying to go 60 miles an hour. We're at 61 or 62, that's all okay. But all of a sudden, you look down and say, geez, I'm going 66 miles an hour. I didn't mean to go that fast. You got somebody watching that each week for you that say, you need to take the foot off the... Or conversely, I'm going slower than I wanted to. And then we come back and say, here's a rebalance sheet. Here's where we recommend you move this, this, and this. If you agree with it, you just sign the bottom of it, send it back to us. We send it to the custodian enacts all that. Probably after that, maybe twice a year, we might come to you and say, we're making a recommendation for a change in funds.
know, either adding a fund, subtracting a fund, this manager now has left this firm. So it's not going to be, although we need to monitor it each week, because you never know when that event could occur, it's not going to be every week we're coming back. It's going to be actually maybe a couple times a year between rebalancing and manager changes. Manager changes, we'd bring back to the committee at our quarterly meetings, unless there's a need to move like that, say, here's what our recommended change is. But instead of saying, we think you need to change, here's three choices, then you put those out, and maybe you pick the one that we thought was the best, maybe you pick the one that was the third best, you know. Now you know exactly who we think is the number one choice. So, at least our opinion. So, it's any of these, you know, I don't want you to feel like I'm pushing you to any of these, but I'm trying to push it to, I want to get you, you've moved a long way, but I want to get you from good to excellent.
Yeah, I guess a point of confusion for me is the problem is performance not at best of class.
Mm-hmm.
And solutions toward that are different allocations and managers on one hand. And on the other hand, a different process, a more intensive process. Utilizing, a mechanism that you have. And I'm trying to sort out in my mind, can we get 80% of the way toward best in class just by improving the selections that we've made under our current process? Or can we only get 20% of the way and the rest of it really is this more intensive approach? And I'm trying to figure out what are we getting for what we're paying? And is a way of saying it.
No, it's a fair, yeah. And I don't know whether you can get to 20% or 80% of the, that's the, you know, my observation is it's been three years almost of getting to best of class. And it's definitely been an improvement. So from where you started, you know, I'd say you went from here to here. It's just how do you get this delta, and is it worth paying additional more to get that, or do we find a mechanism? Say, okay, look, I'll come back in the next meeting, but I'm going to come back to you with like four or five recommended changes, and I'm going to come back and say, okay, but now you have three choices here, and three choices here, and three choices here, and do you blend? Because it's not just picking the quote best of class. This manager might fit well with this one. But this manager might fit better with this one, and so on and so forth. And how do you engineer that all together?
I don't know if I'm comfortable making changes without the committee. I prefer things, even if it's a weekly thing, a weekly report. I still feel comfortable with the way we have it set up with the committee. I do feel meeting quarterly has helped. I know we changed because it was only a couple times a year or whatever. I don't know if we can really make any changes quickly because we do meet quarterly. So that's where my dilemma is. I don't know if we're ready at this point. I don't know if I'm comfortable yet to pay the extra fees at this point. I mean, we still have other changes going more into international, things like that. And see if we can keep making changes here as a committee before we say, okay, we've exhausted all options at this point. Now we'll hire somebody or pay additional fees.
Yeah, looking at the performance, 2-year performance, 12% in OPEB, right? And our policy index would yield 14.6% 2-year performance. So there's 2.6%, which gives a lot of room for a 0.1 additional fee if we could expect to get that much improved performance. That's what I'm going through in my mind.
Let me throw an idea out at you, okay, if this works for you.
why don't you try it for 6 or 12 months and you don't pay us any extra? And at the end of that time period, if you think it was worth it, then you can pay us. If you don't think it was worth it, you don't. And I'm okay with that. You know, I really want to get you to where I want you to get to, okay? And yes, I do think ultimately we should be paid more if we're doing all those things. But the proof's in the pudding, too.
Right.
So I would be, truly would be very comfortable with something like that if that works for you. But I would suggest, just from hearing what I said, I don't think you want to go to option two. Okay, that's the one where we make the changes. I still think you'd like to keep your hand on the wheel, and I think that would, you know, I think you'd, if you decide you want to do something, you'd go option three. And then so weekly we'd send you the report, and if there's a need for a change, you send it to the, you know, what some of our other clients do is they just email it around, say, hey, are you okay with this recommendation? As I say, it's very, very, very rare that we'd ever make a recommendation for a manager change that was off of the, not at a meeting like this.
Okay.
It'd have to be caused by, boy, the key person, you know, died or left, or there was this SEC something or other that happened, you know, I mean, that would be very, it'd be more of a, here's the rebalancing, you know, thing, because you've gotten beyond the ranges that you want to be at.
I like the recommendation to see what we will get for the money, if it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is a great option.
If mechanically that can work, I believe email notifications can work for me. I mean, that works for me. So
okay.
That being the case, I would make a motion that we accept this this proposal. Option three.
Option three.
With fees deferred based on performance.
Okay. I have a motion to accept the proposal by Pierce Park Group. Option three, fees would be deferred for 6 months, is what you said.
Well, let's say 6 months. And if at 6 months you're still not sure, we'll make it a year. I won't go past a year. That's, but you know, if you're still at that point, you know.
Okay, 6 to 12 months, depending on performance.
Yeah.
Do I have a second? Okay, I have a second by Mr. Baker. Any questions on the motion? Okay, Mr. James.
Aye.
Mr. Baker.
Aye.
Mr. Leahy.
Aye.
Mr. Lawson.
Yes.
I vote yes. Motion carried. Thank you, Mr. Shen.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. And the last item on the agenda is at your seat was a binded copy of our investment policy. I am proposing some changes to make it current. This is just for you to take a look at, and we will discuss at the February meeting. What it is the first page is just the synopsis of what I've given you. The first tab is the investment policy for the pension plan that was adopted in 2007. The second tab are the changes that we are recommending, and also has a note to the side of why we're making those recommendations for you to take a look at. And then the third tab would be the final clean copy after those changes were made. So this is just more giving this to you for us to discuss in February, to give you an opportunity to take a look at it. It's just to get it current. We haven't made any changes to 2007, so I think it's time to update it.
Yeah. Okay. Very clear. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, and the next item is the 2014 meeting dates. Does anybody have any concerns with those dates?
All at 10 a.m.?
All at 10 a.m. Good. Okay. And any additional business? We will have a council meeting December 10th that will bring those assumptions. Mr. Schoen will be there as well. I'm more than welcome to attend the council meeting if you like. That is it. I will see you on February 20th. I'd like to entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay. I have a motion, a second.
Thanks.
Second by Mr. Baker. Mr. James.
Aye.
Mr. Baker.
Mr.
Leahy.
Aye.
Mr. Lawson?
Yes.
Abbott, yes. Meeting adjourned.